Committee of the committee, being three members of the nine-member House Revenue Committee. This is House Revenue. This is June 8th. We are starting 15 minutes late by a previous announcement. We're going to go ahead this afternoon and begin a public hearing on House Bill 3481. Liz Beth.
Okay, Chairman Butler and committee members, I've given you for 3481 A and Gross a breakdown of section by section, and so that's two pages. You've got 41 sections. This bill's got a lot of different components, so I'll try to go through some of the major parts of it. To begin with, this is providing a property tax exemption for biofuel production facilities. Basically outlines this new property tax exemption for biofuels productions or fuel additive production facilities. And this is in the statutes that was dealing with the ethanol production facilities property tax exemption. So it's along those same lines. It requires a property tax application to include a list of the taxing districts in which the property is located and a written notice to each taxing district specifying that a taxing district may elect not to participate in the exemption. So as we've heard testimony in the past about these property tax exemptions, this one has an opt-out for any taxing district that chooses to elect that position. So that's basically specifying the requirements of a taxing district that's choosing not to participate in this property tax exemption. Then it goes on and it applies to production facilities for which an application for property tax exemption has been filed on or after January 1st, 2006 for tax years beginning fiscal year 2006-07. Now, it's extending the sunset on the ethanol, biofuel, and fuel additives production facilities to July 1st, 2012. So that's extending the current law sunset for the ethanol as well.
Section 1, Elizabeth, how long is the property tax exemption that we're looking at adding under Section 1?
How many years? Is that what you're asking?
For the record, we now are up to a quorum, so we'll go ahead and continue on as a quorum of the committee. Please, does it include both real and personal property?
I think it does, yeah. It's... I think it's the production facility itself, and I think it's equipped.
Personalty?
I think it is, but I don't see biofuel.
It's all new property.
Yeah, new property. So new property includes both real and personal if it doesn't specify just real or just personal.
And the length of the exemption under Section 1 for that...
Yeah, I think it's I think it's 5 years, but I need to double check.
Okay,
that.
Thank you.
Good call. And it's the same as the ethanol one. Okay, so then we're moving now in sections five through ten. They're dealing with the pollution control tax credit. Now it adds biofuel in Section 5, adds biofuel processing, production plants, and equipment used in plants as qualified production control facilities. Now I just want to clarify that this is an area that is still kind of being discussed on page 4, lines 25 through 37. It's really an area that's still being discussed exactly what who we're targeting with these new facilities. And then just, so basically we have biofuel processing and production facilities and farm storage facility, but it doesn't say the farm storage facility has to be used, you know, to house, you know, biofuel or anything, equipment, but it just says farm storage facility. Then it talks about facilities for that produce electric energy, heat, transport, fuel, or substitute for a petroleum-based product. Then it goes on to talk about the equipment used in all those processes are also exempt. So then in Section 6, though, the thing that could use a little more clarity is on page 6, you know, lines 3 through 5, it clearly states that the biofuel production facility that is construction and it's new after January 1st, 2006, this facility's principal or sole purpose conforms to requirements of ORS 465.155 subsection 3. Well, it doesn't list all those different, you know, components I just listed there on page 4. It doesn't list whether or not they have to also adhere to ORS 465.155 subsection 3. So it would be simpler and easier if the intent was to have all of these still meet the DEQ requirements to clearly specify that in lines 3 through 5, just specify that all of those different things that are now qualifying as production control facilities also still need to conform to the requirements in 465.155. So at this time, that's still a little unclear exactly how broad that is going to be for the other things that are listed there, the farm storage facilities and the other ones. And then as you go on, Section 6 then requires a new biofuel production facilities to conform, as I was just saying, to the requirements of 468.155. It also deletes the current law filing date of December 31st, 2008 for all pollution control tax credit applications. And then in Section 7, the next session, it extends that current law sunset out 11 years to December 31st, 2016. Now, in the next section, this is applying to all tax credits that are eligible for the pollution control tax credit. This is increasing the lower percentage, and as you know, under current law, we have an upper tier and a lower tier projects, and it is increasing both those thresholds. The lower tier, then, percentage goes from 15% to 35% of the certified cost for the pollution control tax credit, and then you're increasing the upper tier percentage from 35% to 50%, and again, this is applying to the specified new facilities in the pollution control tax credit. And then in 9, it's deleting the current law sunset, and then it's that the facility has to be erected and construction beginning January 1st, 2006. Then basically, as you're going on, then we have the next major issue is a new tax credit for producers of biofuel raw materials. And Section 12 basically is the heart of it, where it provides some of the definitions for the new tax credit. It allows ag producers a new personal income tax or corporate excise tax credit for the amount of biodiesel produced in the state from the plant and animal materials produced by the ag producer. And it's specifying that the tax credit equal 5 cents per gallon of biodiesel produced or 4 cents per gallon of ethanol produced in Oregon from plant or animal matter, or $20 per ton of biomass delivered to a producer that uses the biomass to produce electric energy, heat, transportation fuel, or the substitution for a petroleum-based product. It's requiring each then biodiesel and ethanol producer to report to an ag producer the quantity of biodiesel or ethanol produced from the farmer's plant or animal matter sold to the producer. So this is the way in which an ag producer could actually quantify how much of their products were actually made into biodiesel or ethanol. One thing that would clarify this section would be to, you know, I don't know that they wanted both the producer as well as the ag producer of the raw materials to get the tax credit, but it's not at all specified that you couldn't have both of them claiming the tax credit. So that would be one thing that would help in clarifying that this is just a tax credit for the ag producer, and the producer of the biodiesel is not the one that can be taking this tax credit here. Anyway, then it requires each producer that uses the biomass then to produce electric that uses the biomass to produce electric energy, heat, transportation fuel, or substitute for petroleum-based product shall maintain records of the quantity of biomass that they obtained. And again, in here, it doesn't say that they have to report that back to the person that they maybe purchased the biomass from, so that they would have the record and could be the one who could verify if they ever got audited on this tax credit, if you assume that the ag producer is the one who's getting the credit for this and not the person who's just using the biomass to produce energy and whatnot. It restricts the tax credit to the tax liability of the taxpayer, provides a 4-year carry forward on this tax credit, Then in the next section, though, in Section 13, it allows the transfer of the tax credit to another taxpayer. So obviously, as we know, most ag producers do not have much tax liability. So this is going to allow them then to be able to transfer this tax credit and allows the Department of Revenue rulemaking authority to specify the guidelines for transferring of this tax credit.
Do we have the department determining how much other tax credits that get transferred? Does the department presently make
no.
rules on any of that?
No.
Those are all statutory at the present time.
Yeah, the Department of Energy is one that has some transferring okay. of tax credits, but not the Department of Revenue.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, then in sections 14 through 16 adds the new producers of the biofuels raw tax credit to the statutes that are just pertaining to tax credits, so that's just cleanup. And then it clearly states that it's beginning on or after January 1st, 2006 for those tax years. Then the next section is the clean emission school buses. So we have this school bus component, which basically creates this clean bus grant fund in the state treasury, separate and distinct from the state general fund, allows funds to be continuously appropriated to the Department of Education. And these funds are then for the purpose of making grants to school districts. And the funding source for that fund is any federal funds or private donations that are received for the purpose of making these grants, and then they're deposited into the fund. I'm not sure exactly who's supposed to be soliciting or getting the grant writing for that, but I guess Department of Education or something. It's allowing the Department of Education to award annual grants to school districts with certain limitations. Then it specifies that these expenditures on school buses by school districts shall be treated as an approved transportation cost in the state school fund formula. Then it requires the Department of Education to report to the 75th Legislative Assembly on the extent to which school buses have been retrofitted with diesel exhaust after treatment devices or retired, and the results then of these pilot projects that have been funded by the Clean School Bus Grant Fund. It repeals this fund then June 30th, 2014, requires the Department of Education to transfer all monies remaining in that fund to the Department of Agriculture Service Fund. Then we move on to the biofuel or emissions R&D tax credit. And this is a new tax credit as far as I can see. It could be taken in conjunction with the current R&D tax credit. There's nothing that specifies you have to take one or the other. It identifies qualifying equipment as any system or mechanism used in the production of ethanol or biodiesel. Any ultra-low sulfur diesel or any other equipment designed to be used on buses to reduce emissions. Then it creates a new personal income or corporate tax credit for conducting research and development for developing these qualifying equipment that has some commercial applications. It requires the taxpayer to receive certification from the Department of Environmental Quality, and then it specifies that the taxpayer must supply an estimate of the cost incurred or to be incurred. So initially, if you don't know how much this is going to cost or how much you're going to be spending and things on R&D, then you would just estimate, and then when actually you get the certification, DEQ will give you a certificate that would say how much you're eligible for, but it's going to limit then that tax amount that you can actually claim to the lesser amount of that was actually incurred by the taxpayer versus how much was actually certified. So it's the lesser of that. It limits the total amount the DEQ can certify for the new tax credit to $2 million. So there's a pretty strict limit there on that total amount of certifications. Requires DEQ to notify the Department of Revenue of the taxpayers who qualify for the tax credit and the amount certified. And it specifies that the tax credit equals 5% of the amount certified or the actual amount that is paid by the taxpayer, whichever is less.
Does it identify the mechanism that DEQ uses to come to the $2 million?
No.
First in, first out,
no.
As far as you know?
No. It does not speak to that at all. So.
Yeah.
And then it limits the tax credit to the tax liability but allows a five-year carry forward for this tax credit. This begins tax years on or after January 1st, 2006 and before January 1st, 2012. And then it adds the new tax credit to other pertinent statutes of tax credits. And then the next section is just gasoline additive restrictions. It just makes changes to what is actually allowed to be added to gasoline that is sold in Oregon. Then changes are operative November 1st, 2007. Then we have an energy facilities siting requirements, allows oil seeds, waste, vegetable oil, or biomass to be a source of a material for conversion to a liquid for an energy facility. Then it adds production of then electrical energy, generation of heat, creation of transportation fuels, or the creation of substitutes for petroleum-based products to be the definition of an energy facility. And then it defines biomass. Then it goes on and applies to site certifications filed after the effective date of this act. Then we go on and dealing with state government use of biodiesel. It adds biodiesel to the definition of alternative fuel. Then it clarifies that all state-owned motor vehicles on road, off road, or a construction application shall use alternative fuel for operation, but it doesn't make it mandatory. Then we start in with this excise tax reduction or elimination for a portion of it for motor vehicles using biodiesel. Then, and basically, it's eliminating the excise tax if the motor vehicles use pure or a part biodiesel for each percent of the biodiesel contained in the fuel. Then it sunsets that exemption on January 2nd, 2012. And then it goes on and gives that same exemption for farm vehicle registration, but then the farm vehicle registrations vehicles also have to use biodiesel to propel the vehicle. Again, sunsets at January 2nd, 2012. And then the other two are just administrative rules for DEQ to ensure that the rules permit and encourage the sale or lease of new motor vehicles and the new ag vehicles and equipment that use biodiesel and that have been approved by EPA. So basically that's all the different components. As far as the revenue impact, I haven't completed it all. Basically, I looked at the biggest component being the pollution control tax credit and increasing those percentages. And again, that's beginning in 2006. So initially, that's a reduction of about $1.3 million, the 05, 07 biennium. And then it grows in the 07, 09 to 5.7 and then 10.9 in the 09, 11 biennium. Increasing the sunset begins in tax year January 1st, 09. And so that then is a reduction of $1.4 million. And again, this, as we've talked about before, with so many sunsets, this is going to be a staggering. So, you know, you're just getting the new facilities that would be coming on beginning January 1st, 2009 would be the ones that the sunset would be impacting.
How many facilities are there presently?
You'll have to ask DEQ that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chair. Yes, Representative Hass is recognized.
Two questions for Elizabeth. In the past, we've had printouts of recipients and certificates. Do we have that here, or do you have that?
Representative Hass, no, I don't have that, but we can get that.
Okay.
In the past, was it? Because I know I get mainly the tax data from the Department of Revenue as far as just how many different claims that you have and stuff and things. But
there were two things that stood out in the past. That PGE Enron was at the top of the list, and I was just wondering if that was true. And strangely enough, wood chippers, some 500, are they still, they would still be recipients, people
right.
Who bought wood chip machines?
Right. And Representative Hass, and that's really DEQ's data, and they can provide that by different, their data is public, where Department of Revenue's data is not, you know, it's classified as far as what I can show you, and they can, DEQ can break it down more and stuff, and where when I get it from the Department of Revenue, it's in different industry groups, but not like you're saying, with a particular company or something.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Representative Gullizio.
I'm sorry. Wood chippers? I didn't.
Okay. Well, it's a whole last issue.
Right.
Issue. Okay, so the question is on wood chippers, and, you know, I think probably DEQ could do a much better job than I can as far as explaining why they qualify. But, yes, they do qualify, and it's mainly because they are they're chipping up the wood in the sense of, you know, not allowing pollution for, you know, it's reducing emissions some way or another, but I'm not good at explaining it. But
this was before the movie Fargo came out? Okay.
You know, basically that with the pollution control tax credit, you've got to do something to reduce pollution, air, and so that's something that the chippers do. But it's small scales, so that's just that's kind of how it got a lot of attention. This could be anybody who just purchased a wood chipper, you know, could then apply for it.
The highway fund revenue use fuel tax exemption, $258,000.
Yeah, and so this is just a reduction of the highway fund revenue, and it's not general fund money, but that's just due to the elimination here of the diesel tax for and it's estimated based on how much we would project at consumption of biodiesel here in Oregon. And then the local property tax one, $45,000, $250,000, or just assuming $3 million facility to begin with, and then in the first year of 2006, and then 2006-07, and then in the outer years adding one each year to that. And then the other one I missed, I guess, was a new R&D development tax credit. Again, this is limited to $2 million as far as the amount that can be certified, so that really puts a cap on this as far as how much is used in the revenue impact. So it's only about $20 million biennium in 07, 09, or $20,000, $19,000, and then $40,000 in the 09-11 biennium. And I still haven't finished yet with the biofuels production and processing facilities as far as coming in on the pollution control tax credit. And that's really just due to the language and some ambiguity about whether or not how broad this is going to be in lines 25 through 37, and making sure it's clear that they would also have to meet DEQ's requirements and criteria for reducing pollution. And then the other one is the new biofuels raw material producer tax credit, and I will probably use some of the data that we've kind of looked at dealing with the consumption of biofuel by cars here in Oregon. It's just making then the leap from total consumption of biofuel in Oregon to how much would actually be produced here in Oregon. So And again, it would help and be make it clear if you just wanted it for the ag producers that it was just seen that the ag the ones who are producing it are the only ones producing the raw materials are the only ones who can qualify for that tax credit, not the ones who are also manufacturing and making the biofuel. That would be helpful.
Thank you. Other questions of Lizbeth? Colleagues, this is a very complex piece of legislation. I'm concerned about our time here today. We have 20-plus minutes before the House floor session, and we need to be there on a timely basis. Please express to me your wishes, whether or not we come back here during the reception for the Hatfield or whether we come back here at 1:30 tomorrow.
1:30
tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Representative Golson?
Mr. Chair, I'm involved in judiciary tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Okay. So that would conflict. Colleagues, I'm just very concerned that...
1:30 tomorrow.
1:30 tomorrow.
This is going to take some time to slice and dice.
Yeah, okay. We've got six folks thus far that are here, and Representative Krupp is the next one up. Representative Gordon Anderson, is he in the room? I don't see him. He wanted to testify on this as well. So, Representative Krupp, will you come forward, please? And I guess, colleagues, we'll plan to meet sometime between 1:30 and 2 o'clock tomorrow to see if we can go ahead and continue on with what we don't finish up with today. Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. I want to clarify intent for you right now on a number of items in this bill so that it is on the public record and so that you understand what my intent was in bringing forward many of the provisions of this bill, but not all. The first one is I intend to clarify producers, the producer tax credit for producers is meant for farmers, is meant for tree growers is meant for anyone who produces the base material that is turned into biofuels. It is not meant for the processor or the middleman. Okay, it is meant for the producer who produces the materials. That's the first thing. The second thing is, Mr. Chairman, somehow some language was inserted into this bill, was just called to my attention, that would actually prohibit farmers or a tree grower from producing their own biofuels with their own biomass or straw or canola or wheat or whatever, and be able to use it in their own vehicles or their own tractors. That is not the intent of this bill, and that language will need to be removed on the Senate side. I don't know how that happened, but I intend to fix it. It is my intent with this legislation that everyone who has an opportunity, both large or small, to be involved or engaged in the process of producing biofuels would be allowed to do so. I do not want this legislation to ultimately be construed to be only for large producers. If a farmer wants to do this in his backyard, more power to him. That's the intent of the legislation. Third thing is clarifying the types of materials. I want all types of materials that can be will produce some type of biofuel or bio-oil to be applicable or to be defined as being included in this legislation. I don't care if that's a banana peel based on the movie Back to the Future. I don't care what it is. It can be biomass. It can be wheat straw, which is grown for wheat seed, and then as the straw is utilized to make ethanol, it can be grass seed. It could be any number of things. Whatever material, so I also intend to clarify that in terms of language over on the Senate side, because there is some concern and some ambiguity there. What I'm doing is I'm sharing with you what my intent is as one of the original drafters of this legislation and these concepts. So I just want you to keep those things in mind as you slice and dice the good representative from Southern Oregon opine. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would conclude my comments and would ask you to move the bill forward when appropriate to the next level, as it appears we are winding down, and would love to move this to the floor.
Thank you, Representative Krupp. Are there questions of Representative Krupp? Representative Combe.
Representative Krupp, I don't have a question, but just kind of, for the record, I grew up on a dairy farm, and we had plenty of things that qualify in the forms of manure for this bill, and so I'm really appreciative that your intent was to do something with that for the producer, the dairy farmer, whoever they are, because, you know, I have 13 brothers and sisters, and we shoveled a lot of that stuff, and I would have liked to have had some benefit from it.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Comp, there are those who accuse us of shoveling that around here, too, but that's a story for another day.
Right.
Thank you. Further questions for Representative Crabb? Representative Escobar is recognized.
If you're the one to answer this question, but there's a $20 per ton credit in this pandemic. What are they getting for hog fuel anyway?
I don't know. That's a good question.
That's a real good question.
I know poplar trees, of which I grow some, and Mr. Chairman and Representative Esquivel, poplar trees, of which I have some, I believe the per ton chip now is somewhere in that $35, $40 range. So hog fuel is probably down in that range, I would think.
I think hog fuel would probably be less, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I would think it would be in that $20 range or less, perhaps.
So what the bill does is it provides both that they could collect that way and then a $20 biomass delivery credit against their taxes.
Yeah, the intent here, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is to allow some economic incentives for everyone in the food chain. Basically, everyone from the beginning producer to the person who collects the product, takes it to the processor, the fuel blender, refiner, and including the gas station owner. Okay, because there are federal credits that come into play here also, and Elizabeth can articulate what those are. So there are a number of incentives here for everyone along the line, and that was the original intent, is for us to create a to make sure that no one was left out, so there would be incentives for people to say, yeah, we think this is a good direction to go. And hopefully, and you did not have the benefit of hearing this in front of other committees, but there's been testimony about the technologies that are emerging for the production of fuels, both biodiesel and ethanol, that because that emergency technology, or that emerging technology, is bringing the cost of production down, that it will become a very viable and very real opportunity for us to provide ethanol blended gasoline and diesel blended with biodiesel at the pump for lower prices than they are today. And that technology is actually here, and that's part of what we're trying to do. This package is designed to accelerate this business in Oregon, because it is going to come. There's a window of opportunity here for a number of reasons, or market reasons. And I'm not going to go into them now because I need to shut up and get out of here so you guys can conclude your work. So there's a lot of good reasons why I want to accelerate this entire process and industry in the state of Oregon. It means a lot of jobs and a lot of money in the coming years. And one thing quickly I want to share with you about the producer's tax credit is I do not believe it will have a lot of fiscal impact here in the state of Oregon in this coming biennium, 05-07, because we haven't built any of these plants here yet. And before you can claim that tax credit, you got to build a plant so someone will buy the product from you. If we build a couple of plants, and there are a couple that will be completed or almost completed by this time a year from now, if you're going to grow crops for that, you have to plant those crops in the spring. So there won't be any crops planted here in 2005 for biofuels, is what I'm saying. There will be some in 2006, depending on how many plants get built. So I don't think you're going to see a large fiscal impact in the 05-07 biennium. Beyond that, in the coming years, perhaps so. But in 05-07, I don't think it will be substantial.
Thank you. Further questions of Representative Krupp? Representative Gould.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Krupp, I don't know if you'll be able to answer this question, because I don't know if you were the original drafter for this portion. I'm looking at the clean emission school buses, or if maybe Elizabeth might be the right person to answer. I'm reading the section 17, 18, 19, and I mean 20 and 21, and I don't get it, I guess. It's not asset forfeiture, so. what's the revenue stream in order to support the Clean School Bus Grant Fund? I don't see that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Olson, you're right. I'm not the person to ask that question.
Lines 35 and 36, it just says any federal or private donations received for the purpose of making the grant. So that's the only revenue source I see in it, is that somebody's going to have to apply to get this federal money and solicit private donations. So that doesn't really even say who's supposed to be responsible for that. I guess the Department of Education, but it doesn't clearly say that.
Mr. Chairman, if I may expand just briefly, Representative Olson, a gentleman is sitting right here behind me who intends to build. If you will move this bill quickly and we get this done soon, before the end of this month, they're going to build the largest biodiesel facility in the entire world right here in Oregon that will provide some close to $600 million in tax revenue to the state of Oregon and local governments over the next 6 years. And they have committed to retrofitting every single school bus in the state of Oregon free of charge.
Do you have a piece of paper, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure someone would love to testify to that effect, because it is something they've testified to before.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did Representative Olson ever show, or did someone call his office?
No, I'm here.
I'm sorry. Representative Anderson? Welcome, Representative Olson. You want to testify on behalf of Representative Anderson? Okay. All right. Okay. We have, now, colleagues, we have one more bill that's lined up for today for public hearing. I'm being told that in order to carry this over, it's got to be in work session. Is anyone signed up for 2070? Being no one signed up for 2070, I'm going to go ahead and open contemporaneously a public hearing on House Bill 2070, and then I'm going to, by motion of the chair, move the work session for 2070 over to tomorrow at 1:30. So I'm going to close the public hearing on 2070 and order the work session for tomorrow on our schedule for tomorrow. So that will move 2070 off of today's calendar, and we will continue then on with the public hearing portion, and we'll do the work session tomorrow. We don't have to be reposted for the work session, but colleagues will have to be back to do the work session on the three bills that are before us for work session today. That would be 3481 if we're ready to move on it, House Bill 2070 if we're ready to move on it, and Senate Bill 23 for the purpose of, and we could do 23 right now.
Okay. We'll repost for the work session. We just don't, not subject 24 hours.
Okay, all right.
We'll repost it Saturday.
Okay, we can repost for the work sessions. Now, why don't I do this? There's a one matter of business to take care of so that we can get the work session for Senate Bill 23 off of our calendar. And I'm going to suspend for a few moments the public hearing on House Bill 3481, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 23 for the purpose of, for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 23 for the purpose of adopting the conflict amendments. Is there any objection to suspending the rules to have a rehearing to reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 23 for the purpose of adopting conflict amendments? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 23, work session. Mazin, can you tell us what the nature of the conflicts are?
We need to reconsider the political amendment, too, Mr. Chair.
Me, too.
There's an amendment?
We've done an amendment on 23, was A. It was became A1. To reconsider that vote too, right?
So we'll have to reconsider the motion by which now that we're in work session, the chair moves that we reconsider the motion or the vote by which we appended the A3, was it?
A1.
The A1. A1, open my file here too. We appended both A1 and A2.
A2 as well.
Just A1.
Okay. By which we appended the dash A1 amendments to Senate Bill 23. Is there any objection to reconsidering that motion, that vote? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We will reconsider then, and I'm still looking for the A1s.
The A1s, Mr. Chair, were the emergency clause that we put on the...
That's A2.
A2.
Okay. So the motion is that the chair makes a motion to reconsider the vote by which we appended the A2 amendments dated 6205 to Senate Bill 23. Is there any objection to that? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Mazin, this was an emergency clause.
A2,
right. Right.
We did the A2.
Right. For your fast, kid. Thank you. Okay.
Okay.
Mazin, what of the emergency clause?
Mr. Chair, the A3, this whole thing is for a Band-Aid, as you remember, for the debt council. Now, the A3, what it does, what came out with the process that we've gone through, that Senate Bill 23A had a conflict in language and legal language with two bills that previously have been passed. They passed both chambers and went to the governor and they were signed. Those bills are House Bill 33 and House Bill 2395. those two bills, the conflict comes from in the first one, in House Bill 2395, to take them one by one, comes with this, with Senate Bill 23, because they both were trying to amend the ORS 294.035. I'm sorry, in your SMS it says 0.33, but it's actually 0.035. They were both trying to amend it. And the amendment that was carried, or the whole amendment of the law intended by House Bill 2395, was to allow the local government deferred compensation funds that local governments keeps for its employees to be invested in stocks as well as mutual funds. However, because it touched on the same law, it kind of put things into a different cleaning up format. Now, Senate Bill 23 came to reorder the statute as it was, and in the same time, take some out and clean up language of different sorts and so on. So we have in the conflict resolution amendment, or the conflict resolution, in the conflict amendments A3, what has transpired basically in the first page, where you look at section 13A on line 7 of the first page, what it does, it says if the enrolled House Bill 2395 becomes law, then the new language, which is the language in House and Senate Bill 23, because it's more numerous and more thorough in the discussion on the revision that it has put, and cleans it back and appends to it on page 6, line 4, the L as in what was number 12 or subsection 12 on House Bill 2395. So it puts together the two languages, manages them into one language amendment. So that what needs to be done for the conflict between House Bill 2395 and Senate Bill 23. Now the other House bill, which is 2033, also works on parts of the statutes. Basically, ORS 295.005, and also it adds a new section within the law between 295.005 and 295.261. Then the conflict comes as the House Bill 2033, this is the one that we've heard in House Revenue, that tries to allow public funds to be deposited in accounts without having to have collateralization, but if it's up to the 100,000 mark, then no further insurance is needed. All the language within the statutes were touched and changed accordingly, and the bill passed and became signed into law. The conflict, if this Senate bill passes without further adjusting to that fact, it will reintroduce the laws into where they were before.
Mazen, this is much more involved than what I'd anticipate. I'm sorry. I thought we had an amendment as a brief amendment, and so I've got 23 that we are presently in work session on to hold it at. Right now we're in the process of reconsidering the vote by which we passed the A2 amendment, which is included in the A3, I see.
Yes.
So, colleagues, That's a work session. I'm going to close the work session on 23, and that will flow over till tomorrow, where we can take a look at the information that you've got here. Now, colleagues, I still have four people who want to testify, with more notes coming forward, folks that want to testify on 3481. And at this particular point, I'm not sure exactly what to do. We would have to post for a 24-hour 2 o'clock tomorrow to continue on with the public hearing. Okay. We'll do that. We'll recess until tomorrow. All I can do is apologize for the fact that we got started.
You can recess until after.
Okay.
And then you don't have to have a quorum when you come back.
All right. Let's do that. We'll recess until we get back from the floor session. And let's plan for right now 3 o'clock, which would conflict with the reception. The Hatfield reception, but we will recess until 3 o'clock, and then hear the rest of the public hearing, public testimony on this particular matter at 3 o'clock. And we don't have to have a quorum at that time. And then, colleagues, we will post for 1:30 tomorrow to continue on with work sessions on Senate Bill 23, work sessions on 2070, and a work session on 3481. With that, we will close until 3 o'clock. Colleagues, we'll come out of recess. We'll continue on with the House Committee on Revenue. It's a little after 3:30. We finished with a portion of the reception for and the House resolution, concurrent resolution to honor former governor and now senator and senator retired Hatfield. We were last in as we went into recess in a public hearing on 3481. We will continue on with the public hearing on House Bill 3481. I had Representative Krupp. He's finished up his testimony. And Representative Gordon Anderson, has he showed back up? He's not here. Okay. Signing up to speak on behalf of House Bill 3481 starts with Matt Blevins and then Jack Desmond, or Martin Jack Desmond. And then I'm sorry this is not printed, but it's going to be...
Oh, my.
It must be an MD.
Yeah, I think it's this guy.
Okay. Carlson? Okay. And if those folks would come up, Matt Blevins, Jack Desmond, and Charles Carlson, please. Thank you. Please proceed, Matt.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. We want to thank the committee for taking this bill into consideration. I have more thorough testimony that I've handed out that folks can read through, but I'll sort of cut to the chase on this to expedite this. We have continued to work for a while with Representatives Dinkfelder and Krupp to try to put together this comprehensive package to incent and encourage the biofuels industry to get off the ground here in Oregon. We believe that the question of using biofuels is not a question of if, but when, and the question really is much more about will Oregon become a leader in the biofuels industry. We think we have a great opportunity to do that. We think this is a great opportunity to bridge the rural-urban divide and do something that's both good for the environment, good for the economy, and really sort of a quintessential Oregon solution on a lot of different fronts. So with that, we had the original package of bills was House Bills 3030 through 3035 and Senate Bill 736. The current incarnation of that, House Bill 3481, includes a variety of different elements of that, which we are excited to see. It does also include a couple of other elements, some of which we're not as excited to see, and also doesn't include some things that we would hope would be in the package. I think at the end of the day, we would like to see the committee continue to move this through the process and move this to the floor so that it can continue to be worked within the Senate and that we can come up with a package that works for both sides of the building by the end of the session here, which hopefully is approaching sooner rather than later. We would just put on the record the couple of concerns that we have. One, we do believe that a renewable fuel standard that sets a base level of ethanol and biodiesel that is in pumps here in Oregon in both gasoline and diesel sold in the state is an important part of creating a base level demand for biodiesel and ethanol to get this industry off the ground. It's currently not included in this bill, and we would like to see this in the final version. So we would encourage the committee and members to continue to look at that as an important part of this bigger package. As raised earlier by Representative Olson, we do have concerns about the fact that we have a clean car or clean school bus fund that's established in this legislation, which is great. The challenge is there's no funding in that, and while it is all good and fine to hope that the federal government can weigh in and provide the funding for those, and in some cases they're able to do that, they're unlikely to do that unless there's some small amount of matching funds from a state to show there's a commitment at the state level to that. So it is important that there's a base level of funding to help get that off the ground, and in the original legislation there was funding for that. So we'd again encourage the committee to look at ways to fund that fund. Third, we do think that there's a place for the state to have a base level mandate use in fleet of biodiesel to help, again, create a base level demand for the, and that, again, is not included in this current legislation. And then finally, we have real concerns about the addition of a dramatic expansion of the pollution control tax credit that's included in this bill. We think that at this point in the current form, that can present, can be a poison pill for this entire package as it moves through the process. So we would encourage the committee to look at the original modification of the pollution control tax credit that was included in House Bill 3031 as this moves forward. So those are the issues that we have. Other folks are going to speak to those. I can take any questions on that. We definitely are assuming that there's going to be additional amendments to this over on the Senate side that will address a number of the concerns that were raised by revenue staff and some of the other issues that are out there. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Matt. You're not proposing any of those amendments on the House side?
Not at this point. We prefer to sort of see this move at this point and continue to work with members to do that as a huge amendment over on the Senate side.
Okay, we'll see if the if our colleagues in the House committee have any appetite for that. But are you prepared to offer those amendments at some point on the House side?
We're happy to work with the committee as they'd like to. So,
okay, thank you very much, Matt. Questions for Mr. Blevins? Please, Mr. Desmond.
Chairman Butler, other distinguished state representatives, my name is Martin Jack Desmond. I'm author of a book entitled Back to Basics, How to Create Good Jobs in the Pacific Northwest. I just want to make a couple of points today. The first is three-quarters of Forest Service lands in Oregon and Washington are at moderate to high risk of destructive wildfire. My book in part talks about how we can reduce the fuel loading on these lands and in part convert that woody biomass into ethanol. I want to make a couple of points. About a month ago, Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer signed into law a bill requiring a 10% ethanol blend in the state of Montana. Minnesota, I understand, is on its way to establishing a 20% ethanol blend. They already have a 10% blend that's been in place. At the national level, the Renewable Fuels Association is pushing for 8 billion gallon renewable fuels standard. And so I'll just sort of conclude my testimony and just want to encourage the Revenue Committee to pass out House Bill 3481, but I personally would also like to see a renewable fuel standard in the final bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Desmond. Questions for Mr. Desmond? Thank you very much, Mr. Desmond. Mr. Charles Carlson?
Yes, I'm Charles Carlson, President of Cascade Grain, and we'll be starting to build our 100-million-gallon ethanol plant in Columbia County later this year. I come here to support the bill. There's a, of course, as an ethanol production facility, we would like to see a renewable fuel standard be added to this. You have in front of you some of the air information that's come out of California and New York, Connecticut, since they have switched to an ethanol instead of MTBE, and they're seeing much reduced ozone levels because of it. In addition, of course, right now ethanol reduces the price of gas roughly 7 to 8 cents a gallon, so it's a win-win for the consumer as far as being a cheaper and cheaper cost additive into the fuel to reduce its cost and reduce the smog in the state levels. Additionally, we have besides that, we have a refining industry that is at its max capacity. 95% right now is where the refining industry is running. We're importing 1 million barrels a day of finished product because we can't refine it in here. So we're not looking at replacing refinery capacity because it's overtaxed already. We're just talking about hopefully trying to slow our growth at a 2% growth rate, which what we're currently going through in gasoline, that amounts to about 2.8 billion gallons a year increase, and we can't even match that increase with ethanol, but just this is one way of stemming a little small portion of that tide. In the bill itself, things I'm glad to see that got in there was MTB and other similar type additives being banned. I hope that goes through so we can add ourselves to the other almost 20-plus states that have already banned MTBE. The one thing in there that I've gone through before, because we already went through the Energy Facility Siting Council, it was a quick way to sidestep that issue, but it doesn't come at a, it comes at a cost, because in the administrative rules, you are then limited to how much product you can move from your plant by truck. If it's over, I think it's about a mile from the plant, it limits it to 10% of your production. So, and one of the things I've been talking to about the to the Energy Department is, once we get it built, can I come back and get my site certificate so I can get rid of that administrative rule? So that is a cumbersome thing as far as not so much our plant. We're going to have good water access so we can move by barge. But in other areas where they're looking to develop, if they don't have adequate infrastructure, it could be a main issue because of that administrative rule that's in there that limits the amount of truck traffic you can put your product out by.
Thank you. Representative Berger is recognized.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Croson. I can't visualize what a facility like this looks like. Does it look like, act like in any way your traditional refinery? How many people are employed in a facility like this? What kind of investment does it take to get one started, and how many are you planning in Oregon if we pass something like that?
Okay, I'll ask you quickly. A 100 million gallon will cost you roughly about $125 million in plant construction costs. There's additional cost for working capital and debt service and all that, but that's a general construction cost. It will employ 50 people at the ethanol plant. We will have a carbon dioxide plant by a separate company on site that employs another 30, so this will produce about 80. The footprint of the plant is about 40 acres, so it's a fairly substantial plant. You know, most of the tanks, when you're talking fermenting tanks, are nearly 800,000 gallons, and the beer well is a million. It's a big spill.
Thank you.
That was responsive, Representative.
Yes, except the how many is he planning to build? I didn't get that from him.
Well,
that's okay.
How many? I know they want to, the equity sponsors that we're working with want to build 2 to 3 more.
Thank you very much. I just wondered, relative to the 100 or the million gallons a day of finished product being imported for lack of refinery capacity. Of course, Oregon has no refineries.
That's
closest
correct.
Is Martinez or Anacortes.
Yep.
Tell me where that refinery is taking place, where that refining is taking place.
A lot of it's taking place over in the Mideast or over down in Venezuela.
So they're actually refining it in foreign countries?
Foreign countries in Brooklyn, yes. That's just imported in. And it breaks out, I think, in an area. I have it in that narrative. It's about 800,000 barrels of gasoline and 160-some thousand barrels of diesel.
Daily?
Daily.
Gets imported of finished crack product? Then.
Yes. Okay. And we produce roughly right now about close to 290,000 barrels a day of ethanol. So, I mean, we're about one quarter of what gets imported on a finished paper nationwide.
Further questions of any member of this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate your being here today and appreciate your being able to wade through the process of the hearings today. Sharon Banks, then Mike Graney from the Department of Energy, and John Ledger from AOI. Well, let's see. Let's wait on John. Looks like he comes with friends. Oh, Mark Nelson, you want to come down? Dave Nelson, sorry. Dave, why don't you come up right now? I didn't get you on here. Go ahead, Sharon.
My name is Sharon Banks. I work for the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority in Lane County, Oregon. I'm currently the project officer for a $500,000 grant to retrofit school buses in Oregon with exhaust after-treatment devices, commonly referred to as retrofits. I'm here to ask for funding to be added to this bill for school bus retrofits. Setting aside even a small amount of money for this purpose will be effective in leveraging large amounts of federal money for Oregon. EPA is currently in the process of accepting applications for $7.5 million in grants for retrofits for schools nationwide. And in order for our Oregon grant proposals to be competitive with other states, they need to have source matching funds. Diesel exhaust contains highly respirable particles that are laced with over 40 carcinogenic substances. Engines are going to get cleaner due to more stringent EPA regulations, but many of our schools cannot afford to buy new buses. School buses have been identified by EPA as a priority for retrofits because multiple studies have shown that exhaust collects inside the bus at a rate 4 to 8 times higher than behind the bus. To make matters worse, children are much more susceptible to diesel exhaust than are adults. They breathe at a higher rate and their lungs are just developing. In Oregon, this is a statewide problem. Children who live in rural areas often have the highest levels of exposure because rural districts have the oldest buses that are up to 10 times more polluting than the new buses. And the routes in the rural areas are longer, so children stay on the bus longer. School bus retrofits are not experimental technology. EPA has tested and verified effectiveness of diesel retrofits on reducing harmful emissions to children. This technology will be mandated on all buses that are manufactured 2007 and later. The problem is that diesel engines last for 30 years. We have buses on the road in our Oregon schools that date to the 70s and 80s. And we have the technology to completely eliminate this problem. We just need the money to pay for it. EPA is passing out money for this purpose, but if we as a state have nothing to offer and nothing to contribute, the federal dollars will be allocated elsewhere. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Ms. Banks. Questions for Ms. Banks? Thank you very much. Mike?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Rainey, Director of the Department of Energy. I also support House Bill 3481, the biofuels legislation, a series of bills that are largely picked up in this bill were endorsed by the governor as part of his list of energy bills earlier this year. Particularly want to commend to the committee sections 27 and 28 that ban MTBE and other hazardous materials. Also, sections 29 to 31 that expand on the existing exemption process for siting of ethanol production facilities that meet certain requirements that minimize environmental impacts. Those changes that are in the bill would expand that to include not only certain agricultural materials, but also forest materials as well. And provide the same exemption for biodiesel facilities. There are some provisions in some of the bills that were not picked up in this that we would like to see either the committee consider when the bill's on this side or in the Senate, including a minimum use requirement on state agencies in terms of state vehicles and also renewable fuel standards statewide. But I do think this is a good start, and it's a good beginning of what I think would be a very important component of Oregon's renewable energy development and would have significant environmental benefits and benefits for rural Oregon as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Mike, questions for Mr. Rainey? And Dave Nelson, thank you for coming.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing the Oregon Seed Council and the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. We, too, want to support your action on House Bill 3481. The bill has our support, though it has some technical problems that need to be dealt with along the way. And some of those I may just point out to you because we will be bringing amendments to those, to the bill. On page 1, on line 12 and 13, the bill definitely addresses waste or residue from agriculture, yet it seems to say on page 10 on section 12, subsection A, that an agricultural producer only is defined as an agricultural producer and becomes available or avails himself to the benefits of Section 12 if they sell the product. So they cannot produce biodiesel on their own farm with a little biodiesel manufacturing plant, use their own stuff, and avail themselves of the tax credits that, that accrue to that. Representative Comp mentioned earlier the dairy waste issue, and the there are a number of methane generators that are using methane emissions off of dairy waste to generate electricity. But if you look on line 33, a tax credit of $20 per ton of biomass is only available if it's delivered to a producer. Well, nobody's going to tank up their dairy manure and haul it over to Mr. Graney to make the use in his methane generator. They're going to build it on their farm, use it there, and so on. If you flip back, Mr. Graney mentioned the siting exemptions for ethanol plants and or biodiesel plants, and those are good exemptions. If you turn to page 19 and look at line 16, 17, and 18, cellulosic biomass is defined as barley grain, grape seed. I don't know if it's wine grape seed or Thompson seedless grape seed. I think that was supposed to be rape seed because that's what we were talking about earlier. Forest thinnings, rice bran, rice hulls, rice straw, soybean, and sugarcane bagasse, none of which we grow in the state of Oregon. And then only applies to other crops grown specifically for the purpose of producing cellulosic feedstocks that contain lignocellulose or hemicellulose. And the problem there is we produce a million tons of grass seed straw, for example, at a cellulosic material, but we grow it for grass seed, not for cellulose. And so it doesn't qualify under that section either. Same applies to wheat straw, same applies to oat straw and other materials. So there is some work that needs to be done on the bill. Recognize that when you pass it out. We hope that you would send it along and continue to work on it.
Thank you, Dave. Questions of Dave Nelson or Mike Greeny or Ms. Barnes? Remember, Ms. Banks, I beg your pardon. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Let's see. Is Mr. Endicott still here? Mr. Endicott, would you come forward and let's see. Brian Doherty. Brian, you were signed up here, so you want to come forward and go ahead, Mr. Endicott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Thomas Endicott. I'm managing partner of Sequential Biofuels LLC in Portland and also manager of Sequential Pacific Biodiesel LLC in Portland. Just want to make a few comments. Just first to say that the biodiesel market has already arrived in Oregon. It's small, but it has arrived. Sequential Biofuels currently has 12 different locations throughout the state, and we moved about 250,000 gallons of pure biodiesel last year with our distributors. We anticipate about 500,000 gallons this year in 2005. Also included in the packet I gave you is the recent article from yesterday's business section of the Oregonian, also the press release that we put out yesterday, the announcement that Sequential Biofuels, in partnership with Pacific Biodiesel of Maui, Hawaii, and a group of investors here in Oregon will produce the first biodiesel production facility in Portland, will be producing fuel by the end of this year. So this is a viable industry. There are other producers in the room, potential producers, I think. We all see the writing on the wall, but as Representative Krupp had said, this is a question of acceleration. And as Matt Blevins had said, this is a question of will Oregon be an industry leader in the biofuels market. The two pieces that I would, that I'd, obviously Sequential Biofuels very wholeheartedly supports 3481, specifically because of the social, economic, and environmental impacts produced by both biodiesel and ethanol. The two pieces that we were sorry to see removed from the original bills was first the requirement for state agencies to use some percentage of biodiesel. We feel like the state should commit itself to lead by example and certainly uses a significant amount of diesel fuel every year. I would add to that that DAS Fleet already uses a significant amount of B20 in Salem, and that is a good move in the right direction. I'd also like to state Sequential Biofuel support for a renewable fuel standard that was originally in one of those first seven bills. We believe it's an attractive way to kickstart a significant biodiesel production industry in Oregon. Currently, there are about 1 million gallons of biodiesel per year consumed in Oregon, but without added incentives, I think that these volumes will continue to be imported from the Midwest as they are today, and we won't see the economic development potential for Oregon's agricultural industries to benefit from the biofuels industry. So a renewable fuel standard would create a significant market, roughly about 10 million gallons per year on the biodiesel side, and I think that would do a great deal to kickstart the industry here in the state. With that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Endicott. Questions of Mr. Endicott, Representative Hassan.
Could you elaborate on the renewable fuel standard? Why that part is important?
I would say because the thing holding back the biofuels industry in Oregon and the Northwest in general is market. There's not a big enough market to justify the scale of plant that really makes it economically feasible. So a 10 million gallon demand produced by a 2% renewable fuel standard on the diesel side would certainly be large enough to create incentives for a production facility that size.
Further questions of Mr. Endicott? Mr. Doherty?
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Brian Doherty, and I represent the Western States Petroleum Association. I work closely with Representative Anderson in putting together this package of bills to get our companies to a neutral position on the bill. And I want to address a couple of things, primarily the mandates, what they're calling standards here, but what they are is mandated fuel standards, and talk to you about why we're opposed to those. I think it's important to understand what this package does, and I think it's a very good package you have and carefully crafted package in 3481. Everybody would like to have everything on their cake. You want to have all the incentives you can get and get a mandate. As I talked to some of you, I said I'd like to have a mandate that requires anybody that talks to a legislator must have a lobbyist. I mean, it'd be a nice thing to have for my industry. But the point is, a mandate doesn't do what these people believe it does, and an incentive is a better way to go, and I'll tell you why. If you look at the Midwest didn't create their ethanol market on a mandate. They didn't need that to do it. Minnesota has one, has been going based on production, and now Montana has just passed something, but that is not how they created their industry. Today we are blending ethanol in Oregon with no mandate. Why? Because the incentive works. You've got a 51-cent per gallon federal incentive. Not even all these state incentives are in this, and we're blending it today. It works. What you get is a disincentive when you do a mandate. You end up with something that is not competitive. You mess with the supply and demand marketplace. And what happens in a mandate when all of a sudden things get different? Supposing that OPEC lowers their price per barrel to $30, and all of a sudden the gasoline versus ethanol price changes. The consumer is going to have to pay it because they're mandated to have it here when it's not making economic sense. The other thing that's important is this. A mandate does not mandate that a biorefinery buy Oregon crops. For its biorefinery, it's going to buy the cheapest crops it can find. Canada can bring Canadian canola down here very cheaply. A mandate does not mandate that the blenders, our oil companies, blend Oregon biodiesel or ethanol. It just mandates we blend it, and we're going to blend it from wherever we can get it the cheapest. So the idea that we're going to create a market that's going to create Oregon, you can't mandate that we buy it from Oregon farms because it's against the Federal Interstate Commerce Clause. So what you're trying to do here is create a market where you've got a market in California where over 1 billion gallons of ethanol are being consumed each year in California. That is the market. And they're mandated basically by the Clean Air Act. They're in non-attainment in so many cities, and they're consuming that amount of biofuels, of ethanol, and the biodiesel market is there as well. And it'll be here in Oregon if the price is right. And these incentives will allow Oregon farmers and Oregon producers to compete nationally and internationally rather than a mandate in Oregon, which doesn't do that. So the incentives, and if you look at the fiscal impact, the revenue impact of this, it's fairly minor. If you look at what the producer tax credit, the income tax credit, property tax credit really are costing, they're fairly minor for what it can do for this industry. We're the number one purchaser of ethanol in the world. Our companies are. And we'll be the number one purchaser of biodiesel, I'm sure, as well. And we blend it. And we use the blender's tax credit. And we work with this industry very closely, and we'll work with the others. But I encourage you to look carefully at this issue on the mandates versus incentives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of Mr. Doherty or Mr. Endicott? That's the panel. Thanks again. We appreciate you coming.
Thank you very much.
And finally, John Ledger, AOI, Paul Cosgrove, and Bill Linden.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Vice President of Associated Oregon Industries. And I'll just have some fairly quick comments to make because it is getting late and also respond to a couple of things I've heard. First of all, we're very strong proponents of this bill. One of the most important things to do in Oregon is to diversify our economic base. It's just like a mutual fund. And we think this is something that could help get that started. The other thing we've seen, especially in the rural areas, it seems like when there's a boom, the urban areas boom, but the rural areas really don't. And when there's a bust, the rural areas seem to just bust further. And we think this is something that could help the rural areas. This is a big bill, and it has a lot of different things in it, and I think it's fairly balanced and pretty finely tuned. And I would join with Mr. Blevins in saying we would like to see this move along fairly quickly. I think it's going to get a lot of interpretation and attention over on the other side also. And we're sure there are going to be changes as it goes. A couple of quick things that I wanted to speak about, because this always comes up. One was the pollution control tax credit piece of this. And we were very pleased to see in the initial bills that were offered, which actually were not our bills. And I have here a letter from the Oregon Environmental Council to the Sustainability Board, which I'm a member. And one of the items in it is allow farm equipment used for biofuels crop production to qualify for the pollution control tax credit and provide tax credits for biofuels crop production. The problem with the original bill that was brought in was it did add biofuels to the pollution control tax credit program, but it did not extend the program, and it has a sunset on it, I think the end of this year or end of next year. So we'd be doing kind of a physical therapy on a dying patient. So all the things that that is used for instance, helping farmers meet regulatory requirements, dairies meet regulatory requirements, that all would just disappear. It would all be gone. So it really would be a moot issue to put that whole thing into the bill because the program was dying. It's been re-upped ever since 1968, every so many years from when it was started. It's a lot smaller than it used to be. The other thing I wanted to mention on that is that the bill does keep pollution control tax credits in as an incentive to go above and beyond regulatory requirements. To be at the higher tier, it's two tiers, 50%, 35%. And to be at the higher tier, you have to go above and beyond. You have to do something special. And there's a list of things in there, like get a green permit or be ISO 14000 certified, or non-point source, for instance, agriculture, because they really are on the new wave of regulatory activities, or be in an economically depressed zone, so people would build. One of the things you will hear is you'll say, well, aren't these things companies have to do anyway? Well, the answer is no. The higher tier are all extra things, because ag isn't pervasively regulated right now by EPA, so it's things they're doing under the new requirements. And in Oregon, we do not have what many, many states have. In many states, there are laws in the state that say the regulatory agency cannot be more strict than federal minimums. Cannot be more strict than federal minimums. We don't have that. We're a lot more strict than federal minimums, and sometimes, in some cases, 10 times. We have whole programs that aren't required by the federal government. And the reason this has worked for business, and the reason I'm able to go to my members and say buy into this, is because we're going to be more strict than a lot of other states, and in return, we get some type of a tax relief for the pollution control side. And in most cases, you have to build something and hire somebody. I'm only aware of one other state in the country that doesn't have something for pollution control tax. We join that other state. I don't know who it is. So that's an important thing to a lot of our members. And so we were happy to see it added, and it's something that's very important for us. And we think it's something very important for the environment of Oregon. And if you think about it, there's really nothing more Oregon-like than tying an economic tax incentive to environmental improvements. That's a very Oregon approach. So we were happy to see that in, and we support the package, and we'd like to see it move forward very much. I might also add, we did meet with DEQ today, and they have some technical issues that are going to have to be dealt with one way or the other, mostly wording to make the tax program run more smoothly. And so at some point,
probably have amendments being brought in by DEQ or in conjunction with DEQ. The last thing I would add, which always comes up, is the great debate over chippers. And about 4 years ago, maybe six, DEQ air programs, and this is, I used to, as some of you know, I used to run state air programs in another state. One of the biggest sources of air pollution is open burning. And it just dwarfs everything else. It's amazing. So DEQ, at direction of the Environmental Quality Commission, brought in a program saying if you buy a chipper, you qualify for a pollution control tax credit for a piece of the cost of the chipper. And we originally brought in a bill that essentially said you can't do that anymore, except only for big chippers, like big land clearing operations, so you don't burn. And DEQ got fairly exercised over that because they like that program. They think it's good for the environment. So that's not in this bill. The chippers, a lot of people get tax credit for chippers. It's less than 2% of the total dollar amount. But we would certainly have no issues with that whole piece coming out, chippers coming out, if that's what you'd like to do. I know it wouldn't make DEQ happy because I think it's good for the environment, but we would not have a problem. And that's really all I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel is recognized.
I assume when you're talking about chippers, you're talking about a portable chipper that goes through out in the woods, does the clearing, and does the cleanup, and takes that into hog fuel. I would assume that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the $20 credit per ton. You have several types of chipping operations. You have those that have a 5% or less contamination rate, and then you have the other kind that are exceed that 5%. Which in turn you sell as like a biomass like we have in White City where they generate electricity from that type of material. Is that what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll go on a limb. I was going to say on a limb. Okay. I'll speculate here a little bit.
Is that a pun?
Only if you have a chipper.
I looked at the tax credits given for chippers. I broke them down by size. I broke them down by horsepower. There are very few really big chippers, which I think is what you're talking about.
Stationary.
And most of them are pretty small, and I think they're things that people are using for residential land clearing and that, because people like to open burn. So I don't know if that may help. I really can't answer the question. There are very few for like over 100 horsepower chippers. That was very rare. Most of them were in the area of 5 to 50 horsepower. So I don't think they were hog fuel production chippers for the most part. I think they were land clearing chippers where they don't burn the pile of debris. They chip it and haul it off.
Is that responsive, Representative?
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, that's a segment of it.
Okay. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you. Even if it's just 2%, it's $50 million in biennium, so it's not like it's an inconsequential amount of money. I wanted to ask you, though, about PGE Enron's use of this tax credit to decommission Trojan. Do you think that's economic development in that it doesn't really create any jobs if there is this expenditure? Or do you think that's appropriate, or should that stay be written out, or how should that be addressed?
Well, let me go to the first part. I've been tracking the actual cash-in amount of this with Department of Revenue. I have numbers going back to 1980. And the corporate claims for this, it's a very smooth line because it's averaged over 10 years. And the last number I have for 2002 is about $12 million for a year. And I understand it's been dropping. So I don't think I think there's some confusion over what is awarded and what is cashed in. Because many more are awarded than cashed in because companies go broke. You know, you have to make money to use the credit. If you don't make money, don't use the credit. I don't know as you know, I just can't tell you the tax status about PGE or Enron, as you call it. So I really can't address that. I don't know enough about how they do their taxes. I don't have a clue.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I do have a concern about that in terms of if this is an incentive, the biofuels component to this makes a lot of sense to do this environmentally for the state to create jobs. But under the old pollution control tax credit that's set to expire, I just don't see the need to keep giving these credits in places where they're not creating jobs, such as PGE, to wood chippers. And I don't understand. It seems like we've got two different ideas here, both riding the same old horse. And I just was wondering if you could address where the economic development is, particularly with helping a utility take down an old nuclear plant.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think there are two pieces. I don't think you are riding one old horse. I think you're riding two long-lasting, well-conditioned horses. I think what you've done with this type of incentive is you've married economic development and environmental improvement together. Because with a pollution control tax credit, I'll just give you an example. If you're going to renovate a mill, and this doesn't deal with utilities, I know, but if you're going to renovate a mill, if you get a pollution control tax credit, it allows you to renovate the mill earlier because it's cheaper. It allows you to do it earlier. And when you upgrade your mill, you fall under new source performance standards environmentally, which are much, much more strict. So if plants can expand, an expanded plant usually puts out way less pollution than before they expanded. So we want plants to renovate and expand. When someone looks at a facility, and they've got facilities all around the country, and they're going to close a mill, they're going to look at each one. They're going to say, what's the viability of each mill? How can we expand it? What are the future expansion plans? And if they can expand the mill here, it reduces pollution at that site. And frankly, if they're going to lay people off and close the mill, we want them to lay off people in Minnesota or Ohio. Now, on the utility side still is bound by regulations that are more strict than federal. One of the things I always tell people, and I've never been taken up on this, and I would love to, and that is if this legislature will pass and the governor will sign a bill that says we can be no more strict than federal minimums, okay? Is that, you know, we're no more strict than federal minimums, we would trade that for the pollution control tax credit in an instant. In an instant. If we were like a lot of other states and had that legislation, we trade it in an instant. But we don't. And so there may be instances here or there. I don't know enough about PGE to tell you.
Thank you. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Appearing on behalf of the American Forest and Paper Association, and I'll only add a couple of very quick comments. Our members have used the pollution control tax credit for years, and one of the reasons they have is the newest, most modern paper plant in this state is actually older than I am, and as you can tell, that's getting pretty old. These mills have had to be upgraded continuously, obviously, to meet new standards, and that's a very expensive proposition. Let me give you just one example. When I first started representing the industry, I went to tour a paper mill. I think it was the first paper mill I'd been in. This isn't a pollution control project, but it gives you an idea of the capital intensity of that industry. They were rebuilding one of their three paper machines, and if you haven't had the pleasure of seeing a paper machine, it's about four blocks long. It's a very large thing. The rebuild cost was $81 million. They're very heavy capital-intensive plants. And it's what's allowed this industry, as Mr. Ledger pointed out, to stay competitive, even though our plants are much, much older than those that we compete with internally within our company and with our competitors in the Southeast United States. So it's very important to us. Secondly, as Representative has mentioned, biomass is also part of this bill and an important part for the forest products industry. One of your other witnesses mentioned forest wildfire issues, and thinning our forests and properly managing that undergrowth and taking care of it is an important matter, and this encourages the kinds of facilities that will do that and create energy out of those thinnings. And then just lastly, I'm switching hats here to automobile hat, lines of automobile manufacturers. Biodiesel is something the industry wholeheartedly supports, but as Mr. Doherty said, I don't think we need mandates in order to do that. The new Jeep Liberty that will be shipped into Oregon, as just one example, in the next few months as the new model rolls out, will be shipped here with biodiesel in its tank, and that's done without mandates. And the industry has embraced ethanol and biofuels and continues to do so. So I agree with Mr. Doherty, the appropriate place to move is to incent to help hopefully have this product developed here in Oregon. We'll use it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Well, questions directed at home. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Metals Industry Council.
I have described the council's work to you in the past when I've testified on some other bills, so I'll be very brief. Suffice it to say, it's a very important component of Oregon's manufacturing sector. It's a growing component of that sector, and we're seeing growth at the large, small, and medium company size. So it is an area of endeavor in Oregon which we think is yielding some real results in terms of job creation and in terms of expansion. The Metals Industry Council has supported the Pollution Control Tax Credit program since its onset. Our member companies take advantage of it. They participate in it. Many of our capital improvements are very, very expensive. And so having this as an incentive to move companies to make some of the improvements that not only make them more efficient, but also make them more sensitive to the pollution issues that they deal with every day is quite important. We support 3481. It is a package with a lot of pieces to it. I believe it's the balanced approach. And we think that it provides some important incentives in areas that our companies aren't necessarily directly involved in, but overall provides a framework for a omnibus piece of legislation for this session that deals with incenting businesses in Oregon to expand and to grow. So I would commend your support for the bill and be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Well, questions of Bill Lennon or other members of this particular panel? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that was here that didn't get signed up that we haven't heard from that needs to be heard from? Colleagues, we are scheduled on the schedule for tomorrow for a work session beginning at 1:30 on this bill, 3481, House Bill 2070, and Senate Bill 23. Colleagues, I need to just say that there's a lot of warts on this bill that we've just heard. It looks like there's something in it for almost everybody not to care for, and I'm not here telling you that this is going to be an easy bill to be amended and passed out. I don't know that the proponents have even done any kind of a vote count on it. With that, I know that several of you have mentioned one or more items that you're concerned about in the construction of House Bill 3481, and I too have some concerns about passing it out and waiting for it to get fixed on the Senate side. So with that, we'll go into work session tomorrow as posted at 1:30 on these three particular pieces of legislation that we're up today. And we will now close this committee.